Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Have you seen a walking stick in your garden? What about a praying mantis? We are going to be talking about walking sticks and the praying mantis with our guest, PJ Leash, in the studio with me today. He is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, has degrees in biosciences and entomology. So we'll be talking about these two unusual insects, and he'll also take your bug-related questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And if you have an insect you want identified, go to our Facebook page. That's a great, put a photo up there, and we'll try and figure out what it is. PJ Leash, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here, Larry.
Well, let's talk about the praying mantis. To be first, if you, there's more than one.
Oh yeah.
What are they called?
Well, in general, we just call them mantids is probably the commonest term for them. Some folks use the term praying mantid or praying mantis. Sometimes it's spelled with an A, sometimes with an E. But if you use any of those terms, folks generally recognize what you're talking about.
You mentioned before the show that you've seen quite a few praying mantids at the lab in the last few months. Why do you think that's the case?
Yeah, so when it comes to mantids in Wisconsin, we really don't have native species here. We have one species, the Carolina mantis, that kind of gets close to the Great Lakes region, much more common in the southeastern states. We've got a couple of non-native species in our area that pop up from time to time, but in general, they don't do well in the cold conditions. So if we have a really cold winter, it tends to kill off their egg sacs, and their life strategy is they lay an egg sac that goes through the winter, and these eggs are often in very exposed locations. I've seen them on gardening stakes and nursery stock and trees and shrubs. Well, if you think about the winter we had about 3-4 years ago, that basically would have wiped out mantids. It was just so gosh darn cold. And over time, they would have moved up from places like Illinois and Missouri and other warmer locations. Well, we've now had not one, but two consecutive mild winters. And so I was thinking earlier this year, wouldn't surprise me if I had a lot of mantid reports. And in September, late August, and even through mid-October, before we finally cooled down, lots and lots of reports. It was definitely a good year for mantids out there.
Yeah, that's great. And describe them for us.
So mantids are definitely good-sized insects. Depending on the species, they might be 2-3 inches long. The commonest species I was getting reports of this year is what we call the Chinese mantis. It's technically not a native species. It's been in the country since the late 1800s. And this particular species can be either greenish or brownish, and they're good-sized creatures. They can be 4, 5, in some cases, maybe pushing 6 inches long with their legs outstretched. So they'll really catch your attention when you see them with their size.
And we do have a nice video Jill posted of a praying mantis in action. And so you go to our Facebook page if you want to take a look. And again, if you have some photos you want to share, please feel free to post those up on our Facebook page, and we'll see if we can identify them or at least talk about those insects. You know, Abe in La Crosse has something relating to walking sticks, so let's go there. Abe, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Yeah, hi, this is Dave. I didn't know they were mantids. I thought they were mantises.
That's okay.
We've been calling out praying mantis my whole life, so I've never heard different. Walking sticks. I built a house quite a few years ago, and while we were under construction, we had walking sticks everywhere, and I'd never seen one before. And about halfway through construction, they disappeared, and I've never seen one since. And I wanted to find out where you can find them to see them, what attracts them, and if you can domesticate them and keep them for a pet.
Sure.
And I guess, Dave, a quick question for you. Are you in a fairly wooded area?
I built a house, it was in the country.
Okay.
But there were still, it was a suburb, so there were still a lot of houses around, but there was a lot of woods, too. It was a mix.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
I suspect the woods near you probably had something to do with it. So it turns out we've got about 3-4 different species of walking sticks in the state. For the most part, they're not that common unless you're in really good habitat form. And our walking sticks, some of their favorite foods are things like oak trees. They're herbivores, so they feed on the leaves of oak trees. They also like to nibble on the leaves of raspberries and other bramble-type plants. So if you have woods around you, you're more likely to see them versus if you're in the middle of a city, you're just probably not going to bump into them. But still, they can be pretty hit or miss. Sometimes you see them in your yard and you might go 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10 years without seeing them. They can sometimes go through these long-term cycles. We do on occasion actually get outbreaks of walking sticks where you can get these huge population booms. And walking sticks, because they nibble on oak leaves, they can actually do a little bit of damage. It's probably not going to harm the trees that much in the long run. But I've seen pictures, aerial photos, where walking sticks have basically defoliated or nibbled off a lot of the trees from oaks and wooded areas. And if you are in one of those outbreaks, you can actually hear them, their droppings and eggs coming down. It can really catch your attention. It's an unusual thing. But overall, they can be hit or miss. So if you saw them in your yard once a few years back, they're probably still around. But because of their appearance and they blend in very well, it can be hard to spot them.
Actually, the ones that we had, they were living in the house on the new construction. There were hundreds of them. They came in all different colors and sizes. It was really amazing.
Oh, man.
Interesting.
That's really interesting. I'm trying to think of a proper term for this, but are there times when they suddenly all come together or...
Well, not necessarily. I haven't really heard of that myself. When I've encountered them, it tends to be a couple lone individuals here and there.
Okay.
I'd say overall it's probably fairly rare in Wisconsin to see large numbers of them together.
So, Abe, you saw something that not many people will see.
It sounds like it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Kirk in Brookfield next. Hi, Kirk.
Hey there. I have a question. I've seen praying mantis. I just always said praying mantis, but every once in a while in our garden or just out in the woods. But I wanted to have one as like a pet. And what type of habitat do you have to have one in, some type of a tank? And what do you feed them?
Sure. So in general, these praying mantids are predators of just about anything that is small enough for them to catch. I have in the past had some as temporary pets where you can put them in a fish bowl or an empty aquarium tank, things like that. Maybe put a little bit of leaves or sticks in there just for some habitat for them. But for the most part, as long as you're feeding them, they tend to stay fairly happy with that. Probably the easiest things to catch for them, especially during the summer months, would be things like moths showing up at your porch light, because those are easy to get. But you could give them beetles, flies, bees, just about anything small enough. They're really not picky eaters when it comes to that. If you had them as pets, and there are some websites where you can actually order some of the more exotic species and raise them as pets, often what works best in those cases is buying live crickets from the pet store, which you can get for feeding snakes and lizards, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and does it have to be during colder climate? You know, you don't have your heat. We don't have our heat on real high normally, but they need a warmer or anything like that?
Well, it would depend a bit on the species. Now, if you happen to have caught one here in Wisconsin, I wouldn't expect it to live that much longer regardless of the conditions. The reason for that is they basically go through a generation a year, and the females in late summer would lay eggs. Those eggs sit through the winter, hatch the following spring, and then they go from the juvenile stage and reach the adult stage sometime in summer, and they would die out on their own sometime in the fall. You might prolong their life a little bit if you did find one. I would probably err more on a warmer side. They do like some humidity in there as well. So if you had a hand pump spray bottle, you could spritz them with a little bit of water. That often helps. If you are ordering some of the tropical species from India or Southeast Asia, those you do need to keep warm and moist. Otherwise, they have problems when they molt, and that can kind of lead to their demise if they don't molt properly.
If you get eggs, when they hatch, can you release them?
Well, it would depend a bit on the species. I mean, some of the species you can order from biological control catalogs. You know, order a mantid egg case, and the thought is you'll put it out in your garden. And those are generally fine. What often happens is with the egg case, you'll get a whole bunch of very small young mantids, and they will often cannibalize each other. So from
That's what I thought.
Yeah, from my experience, if you started with, say, 100 juveniles, you probably end up with 3 adults out of that entire batch because they just eat each other.
Yeah, because I was putting some into our garden because we get those beetles and different things. And so, at least I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
All right, good. Give it a shot.
One more thing I would add, if you did order one of the kind of Asian species from India or Southeast Asia, if you did get eggs from those, I certainly wouldn't put those outside, though, because they're not native.
Yeah, I didn't want to introduce any type of problem. So, that answers my questions.
Thanks very much for that. Would you order now? It was, in the cold temperatures?
Wouldn't
it make a difference?
If I were thinking of ordering some, I would maybe hold off into the spring, unless you wanted to try raising them indoors, perhaps.
Okay. All right. There you go, Kirk. Thanks again. Appreciate it. Greg in Augusta, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Oh, Larry. I just wanted to tell a quick story about the swarming of walking sticks. I'm 70 years old, and I've only seen this once in my life. I was about 14, and my dad and I were fishing on the Eau Claire River. Anyone that's familiar with Augusta and the Eau Claire River knows where Troubled Waters Bridge is and the Cheney Road. It's a wilderness road. And we were going along the road in the car, and all of a sudden there were walking sticks all over the windshield. And we stopped, and we got out, and we looked into the woods, and you could actually hear them on the ground in the leaves. It was in May, and there were still some dry leaves. And there was a rustling sound, and that area, I would say, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 100 feet square, was totally covered with thousands and thousands of walking sticks. Sometimes they'd be in almost like in a ball. I've never seen anything like it before or since.
Wow, and a swarm. Swarm is the right, that was the word I was trying to think of, Greg. Thank you. Really interesting observation.
Yeah, what I would wonder in a case like that is if it might have been one of these situations where we just had a population explosion or kind of a distinct bump in the population. I had mentioned on the show a few minutes ago, occasionally we do get kind of these outbreaks where they can cause a bit of defoliation in wooded areas. And if you happen to stop in at the time and witness that, you could certainly see an awful lot of walking sticks on the ground.
That would be really cool. And, of course, back then, Greg, you didn't have a cell phone to take the video and photos.
No, we didn't even have TV.
Well, thanks a lot. That's a really interesting story. I appreciate it very much. Well, John in Milwaukee has something about Milwaukee, walking sticks.
How you doing, Larry? How you doing, JP?
Great. Thanks for the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I called last year, actually, in the summer, and spoke to you saying at my house I have a very heavily wooded lot, and there were, I could go outside and within a minute see 50, 100 walking sticks. I mean, it was, last year was crazy. So this year, however, if I go out there, I really have to be out there, walk around, and really look to even see one.
Yeah.
So is it a weather cyclical type of thing, or is it predation that would do that, change it so much?
Yeah,
I would say it could be both of those and then even some more factors we aren't thinking of at the moment. In general, from my experience with walking sticks in the state, it's not common that you bump into large numbers of them. So I would look at it more of, if you did see those large numbers, perhaps those conditions were just right for them last year when you did see bundles of them. Otherwise, in my experience, when I've seen them in good habitat up in the Baraboo Hills, you might, if you're in a really good year in a good spot, you can sit down in the woods and you might see one wander by every couple of minutes, that sort of thing. That seems to be more the norm. When you're finding lots and lots of them, that seems to be a little bit more the exception from my observations.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were definitely, like I said, within a minute, you could see 100 of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. That's a cool sight.
Now, do they have a predator?
I mean, they're not terribly fast-moving insects, so if something could get a hold of them, perhaps certain mammals, perhaps certain birds might eat them, other insects. One of their main defenses, though, is simply their camouflage. I mean, they're greenish, brownish, olive colors. Even with their behavior, when they sit on a tree branch, they kind of sway back and forth sometimes and make themselves really look like a twig, hence the name walking stick. So they can be hard to find. From my experience, one of the easiest ways to find them is if you're in good habitat, just sit down in the woods and wait and watch, and you might see them and notice their movement or hear them moving.
Oh,
so they really can blend in pretty well.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, John. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. We've so far talked about praying mantis and walking sticks, but we can take other questions or comments as well about insects. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post your photos or questions on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow at 11, we'll take a look at the benefits of yoga and how you can find the right instructor. So I hope you'll stay with us for that. Right now, taking a look at the world of insects with P.J. Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him along. And thanks again for joining us. Open lines, so you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Number of photos up here, and the first from Sarah, who wonders if you can tell her what this insect is. Looks like a green insect with some pretty long legs.
It's greenish in color, maybe about a half inch long or so, very slender legs. To the naked eye, it does somewhat resemble walking sticks and those sort of things, although with the general coloration, the appearance, the posture, two things that could be possibilities I can't quite tell from the image. One would be some of our assassin bugs. Can look an awful lot like this. I would tend to think of those earlier in the season. If you went out in the woods in June, July, we have some slender, greenish assassin bugs, genus Zelus, if I remember correctly, and they can be very common. We have something else called a stilt bug, which can be very slender, and stilt bugs basically look like miniature walking sticks, except they're only about a half inch long, tend to be greenish or brownish, and in my experience, they're not very common. In terms of what you could do about it, if you found it recently, I wouldn't expect it to fare very well indoors. A lot of our insects, they're used to either going through the winter, or a lot of them just die out naturally, and if you bring them indoors, they just don't do particularly well regardless of what you provide them with.
Okay. Let's go to Ken in Manitowoc next. Ken, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about those stink bugs,
mm-hmm.
and then also some little fly-type things that came in this winter. Not a whole lot of those bugs. A friend of mine had hundreds of them in her house all winter long. She kept vacuum cleaning them up. But I have some that come in. Is that common for those things to come in during the winter?
For the stink bugs or the flies?
Both.
Well, we do have a relatively new species of stink bug in the state called the brown marmorated stink bug. And that one does like to sneak indoors. It's not terribly common or widespread in the state, but certain areas in the state, the three areas I can think of would be Madison, Dane County area, the Milwaukee, Waukesha area, and then the Fox River Valley up to Green Bay. If you're in those areas, we do see the stink bug. They
like
Ken's to get
in Manitowoc,
indoors.
So.
Okay.
It's north of the Fox Valley, or east of the Fox Valley.
Okay.
But I mean, there's not a whole lot of them, but they are those brown ones.
Yep.
Like the one, my friend lived in Waukesha, and she had hundreds of them in the winter come in.
Mm-hmm.
They were just everywhere.
Yeah, so
that's not as troublesome as these little flies. They're not even a fourth of an inch big, but they're just like almost like fruit flies, but bigger.
Okay. Well, in a case with the flies, it would probably be helpful if you were either to take some pictures of them and email it to me, or even better, if you could collect some of the flies and send them in, just because with their small size, it's going to be hard to tell, and there's a number of possibilities. We've got fruit flies, forage flies, fungus gnats.
Well, I made sure there was no fruits or anything around, so it's not anything where they could feed on, and I don't even know what they're living on because there's nothing around. There's no food. There's no nothing that sets out that they would be able to get to.
Yeah.
Again, it would depend a little bit on the exact type of fly. So, again, if you can get some pictures or specimens and we can figure out exactly what it is, then that tells us the story behind what it's up to, where it's coming from. Even though you might not have fruit and other things around, a lot of these flies indoors that are small can breed in just about any source of damp organic material.
Even potpourri or...
Yeah, some weird things. A little bit of spilled food under the stove, behind a stove, produce, potatoes, something like that, sitting down in storage in the basement, clogged drains, spilled garbage outside a garbage can line. Anything like that can potentially breed some of these flies. Once we figure out exactly what species it is, then that helps us narrow down where we need to search for it.
Yeah.
Okay, I will do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ken, for calling. Appreciate it. Ed sent us a nice photo of a walking stick on a Joe pie weed.
Oh, neat. Yeah, so this is kind of stereotypical of a lot of our walking sticks. They probably have a length of about 3, 4, 5 inches as adults, often this olive greenish color. We do have one oddball species in the Baraboo Hills that has some distinct colored reddish bands on the legs, but our other three species are kind of greenish brownish and have that general appearance on the Facebook picture.
Patricia in Madison has something for us. Hi, Patricia.
Aloha, Larry. I have a chrysalis of a parsley swallowtail in my mayonnaise jar in my on my window ledge. What can I expect?
Yeah.
Well, if you found it on parsley, I would wonder if it might be our black swallowtail, which lysings from that carrot family. The thing with those is they actually need to go through a little bit of cold. A lot of the caterpillars and chrysalises you find late in summer and the fall, folks often think they're helping them out by bringing them indoors. Sometimes that actually backfires and they don't develop properly. So I would consider taking that jar and putting it in an unheated garage or unheated shed. Let it kind of cool down, go through the winter on its own. They're very well adapted for doing that. And that way it'll be able to kind of wake up and develop properly in the spring.
Well, I brought it in the caterpillar stage, so it made the chrysalis, you know, while I had it in the jar, and I had parsley in there also.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I would still consider putting it out in a cooler area. Often that's needed to develop properly, and also in terms of timing, if it did for some reason emerge as an adult during the winter months, that's basically a dead end for it. It's not going to have the right food. It's not going to be able to find a mate to mate with and lay eggs, that sort of thing. So from the insect's point of view, the best thing for it would probably be to go out in a cool location, sit through the winter, and then emerge at the right time in the spring when the temperatures warm up just right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Barbara in Stevens Point wonders if walking sticks can fly.
So the species we have around here cannot. They don't even have wings. When you look at walking sticks around the world, though, and we've got about 3,000 or more species, the bulk of that walking stick diversity is in the tropics, especially Southeast Asia, the Oriental region. There are species out there that have wings. Some of them may be rudimentary wings. Some of them may be larger. There are walking sticks that aren't necessarily slender either. Some of them have widened, dilated bodies to blend in with leaves, again, kind of working on that camouflage standpoint. But when it comes to our walking sticks here in Wisconsin, they aren't capable of flight. They don't even have wings.
Martin in Fifield, let's go to you now. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a hunting shack back in the woods, and every time I go down there, I find a real fine powder out of wood. I've never seen an insect, but I'm suspecting powder post beetle.
Yeah, that's.
And we clean it up every day, every time we go down there, and then there's more when we go down. I was wondering if anything could be done with that.
Yeah, so I suspect you're right. I also am suspicious of powder post beetles. Powder post beetles are these tiny little beetles, and the larvae or grub stage lives in wood of various kinds. Now, out in the woods, they'd live in standing dead trees and things like that, but they can live in old wood indoors in furniture or log cabin type wood, that type of thing. In terms of what we can do about them, our best bet in situations like this is to go with some of these borate-based wood preservatives. And the thought is that these products can either be painted on or sprayed on. They're going to wick into the wood. It's not going to stop the situation immediately, but the thought is if new beetles are trying to get in, it's going to kill those off. So you're basically creating a chemical barrier or layer on the outside of the wood. Some of the product names you can look for, and they're often sold by log cabin supply companies, things like Timbor, Boracare. If you hop online to the log cabin supply companies, they often have a number of these products out there. One of the caveats with these products is they have to be applied to unfinished, unpainted wood
That's what I have there.
Okay.
That'll work then.
That makes it easier because otherwise you got to strip that stuff off.
Right.
Then put the borate powder or products on according to label directions. And then an additional thing you can do is after you put the borate product on, you could consider painting or staining or sealing the wood. The reason that can help is that when the new female beetles go to lay eggs, they like to lay eggs under little slivers and splinters of wood that stick up.
Right.
And if it's been painted and it's nice and smooth, it's not very attractive to them for egg laying. So often a good coat of paint can help in addition to those borate-based products.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be able to paint it because it's rough wood right out of the woods. I didn't build it, but I know what it is.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, out of a sawmill.
Well, the borate products, and they're safe products, too.
Yeah, in general, the borate products, it's the same kind of stuff, essentially, that's in borax soap. So the health risks to humans are really pretty minimal. You're painting it or spraying it onto the wood, it's going to soak in. And then it's just going to kind of sit there for a long period of time and offer some long protection.
Okay, so that's called borate. B-O-R-A-T-E?
Yeah, so you'd have to look at the exact product labels, and it's going to have, where it says the ingredients, boric acid or something else with B-O-R in it. Often it's a salt containing borate-based products.
Yeah.
But Boracare, B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E is one of the products.
Timbor,
T-I-M-B-I-O-R, I believe, is one of the other ones. So there's a number of products out there. As I said, if you went online to a log cabin supply company or called them up, they'd know what you're talking about.
Right.
All right. Good luck.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Martin. Rob in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, you're talking about mantis, and I've had great success raising them here in the Green Bay area. And I would buy a couple of pods of them online off of eBay. They're fairly inexpensive. They're about $6. You can get, depending on who you're buying them from, you can get two or three pods, and you'll hatch several hundred of them out of any one pod. And I've done them indoors in a small aquarium, and then also on my back deck, and with. Somebody mentioned earlier that they're cannibalistic, and yeah, you've got about a 2-day at best time window that you either have to get them outdoors where there's more food or start feeding them. And you can go to a pet store and either get the crickets, as somebody mentioned, but when they first hatch, they're about the size of a mosquito, and you can feed them. You can get this at pet stores. They're wingless fruit flies, and it comes in like a kind of a disgusting looking greasy paste. And as these things hatch, then you can just let them shake them out like pepper into the cage with the mantis, and then they'll feed on that. And as they get bigger, house flies do really well, and My apologies, this might sound a little disgusting, but if you have a dog or you know somebody with a dog and you got a little butterfly net, what you do is you go to where the flies like to congregate, and I think you can put two and two together here. And you squat down on top of the target there with the flies on, and you lift up the top of the net, and the flies will fly to the top of it. Then you can spare yourself any kind of mess from the target there, so to speak, and you can catch three or four, five, six flies all at once, and then just bring them in and release them in your in your aquarium, and then the mantis will have fun with them there and eat them. Any time I raise them, I usually pull out three or four mantis and raise them in the house, and I've done quite well just putting them in a window with a lot of sun, and I'll put up a couple of plants or something in there, and they're more than happy to stay right in that window as long as there's flies and you know, small bugs for them to eat. And, you know, they'll occasionally wander around, but they always return back to the window. And they're very, the more you handle them, the better, more pet-like they become. And they'll go through several molts as they grow older. And in the final molt, they'll develop their wings. And during these molts, which take about 24 hours, to fully complete, they're almost gelatinous. And I've had one that was living on the above my sink in my kitchen on a curtain, and he was hanging upside down going through his molt, and he fell into the sink, and by the time I found him, he was starting to kind of solidify. So instead of his claws going forward and back to grab an insect, they only went sideways, which was pretty pathetic. I'll try to send you a picture of this. But what I trained him to do is hold a pin. I would skewer a live fly on a pin and hand it to him, and he could hold it and eat it from the pin. And I would be on my computer, and I'd watch him, and it's like I'd hear the pin drop into the sink, and I know he's done.
Oh, my goodness me. That great call, Rob. Thank you so much. You're doing everything right. I would really like to see a photo, so post one up if you've got one.
I'm going to see if I can dig it. I've got hundreds of photos of different ones. And then I also have one that I wanted to include that I'm trying to identify. This was just one that randomly showed up when I was raising a bunch of them, and it's quite bizarre. And I don't know if it's indigenous to the area or what, but very small but very peculiar looking. But I'll try to post those up, Larry. And
okay,
Monty, look for Monty is the name of the mantis that has the. You'll see his wings are all real goofy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rob.
I think I might even have a short video of that, and if I can find it, I'll post that as well.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much for calling. What a great call. Well, they're all good calls, but that, I'm looking forward to seeing that video, Rob, so if you've got it, please do send it in, and we'll talk about it when it comes in.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot. Gene in Madison has something entirely different, I think. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Larry. Appreciate the show today. I wanted to talk to you about water scorpions and see if you and your guests could talk about those as well and their relationship to the walking stick. As an aquatic biologist, I run into these in streams in the fall, and this year for the first time I saw one that flew.
Okay. What about it, PJ?
Yeah, so when it comes to water scorpions, they're an unusual group that I don't bump into often, Even though they have the word scorpion in the name, they're not true scorpions. They're actually related to some of our other aquatic true bugs, like the water striders, which are the very common ones that kind of walk around on top of the water and skate around, and other insects like stink bugs and aphids. So they're technically more closely related to those than walking sticks, even though they have this very, very slender body. They look quite a bit like a walking stick or maybe even a praying mantid, but they're actually more closely related to stink bugs and aphids and things along those lines.
Very interesting. Thanks, Gene.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. You've got some great photos. And you should really go to our Facebook page because there are a lot of really cool photos. Jane just posted a really neat one of a mantid, I believe.
Yep.
Kind of hiding in the leaves. And here's Laura sent us another one on the site. This guy was on the siding of her garage, an interesting sort of tan and a green wing, it almost looks like.
Yeah, from what I can see in the picture, I suspect both of these are probably the Chinese mantis, which seems to be our commonest one, and also the largest mantid in North America that we bump into. They often are found on sides of homes. From my observations, I don't know if they're either smart or lazy or both, but they often like to hang out at porch lights at night. When I was in college, I had a friend who even worked at a pick and save down in Kenosha, and the mantids would come in and they'd sit near a black light trap in the atrium where the grocery carts were, because they'd sit by the light. They knew moths and things were going to be attracted, and they would just sit there and wait for their meals. So they're often spotted on buildings or in some cases even in buildings sitting around lights.
Sherry on Facebook shared this story with us. She says, I have a funny mantis story. My husband and I were traveling through the country, and we stopped for lunch at a travel center, and we were waiting in line when a woman kind of shrieked and backed up. And when she did, I saw the praying mantis as everyone else was kind of trying to get away from it. I went over and picked it up and carried it outside, and you'd have thought I'd perform some sort of amazing thing by saving him. I was just happy to see one. That's cool. Well, I guess sometimes if you haven't seen one before, you know, it can be, I suppose, startling.
Yeah, with their big size, again, the Chinese mantis could be 5, maybe even close to 6 inches long. With their behavior, they're generalist predators, so sometimes they may reach out with their hands. I've never been bitten or attacked by them. I've picked them up plenty of times, but if you haven't seen them, they could be a little bit intimidating in appearance.
And Ron emailed to say he once observed a group of tiny spiders hanging from their silk. They each were rising and lowering endlessly like the horses on a carousel. Wondered what kind of species they might be.
Well, hard to tell without seeing them. And when it comes to spiders, juveniles are really hard to narrow down. You can get to family level based on eyes and things like that. But often to figure out the exact species, you either had to rear them from eggs, having known the adult female, or you can only get so far with an identification. In terms of what they were doing, I would wonder if they're really small. Certain spiders, for dispersal means, will put out silk strands to get caught in the wind. We call it ballooning. They can get blown some pretty long distances. So I wonder if there's a chance that might have been going on.
P.J. Leash, our guest today, who directs the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of insects today with our guest P.J. Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Nice photo of Robert sent of a wasp nest.
Yeah, so given the appearance, and this is one of these big kind of stereotypical papier-mâché nests hanging up in a tree, I would suspect bald-faced hornet, although there could be a few other possibilities, some of our other yellow jackets or other wasps. In general, these are similar to bumblebees in that the colony dies out in the fall, other than a few females that have mated, and those females go find hollow, rotting logs, loose bark on dead trees, rock piles, some sheltered spot like that to spend the winter. The rest of that colony dies out, so those nests are basically empty this time of year, and once those wasps have died out, you can collect those nests if you're curious to see what they look like inside, because they don't reuse them from year to year.
John in Black River Falls, it's your turn now. Hi, John.
Good morning. I have a question. We have about 15 acres of old pasture land here, and in the summertime, we have literally thousands of milkweed plants, but I very seldom see a caterpillar for monarchs. There's certainly monarchs around during the day, or, you know, during the summer, but we never see any caterpillars. Now, this area is sprayed for gypsy moth. Is that affecting the monarch caterpillars?
I would say in the grand scheme of things, probably not a whole lot. And the reason for that, when they do go out and spray, they're usually not broadcast spraying huge areas. It might be plots of several acres here, several acres there. It's very strategic, kind of small patches. It's not like they're spraying the entire western side of the state. But also the timing. When they're spraying for gypsy moth, it's in the spring, often in probably the month of May, maybe into early June, whereas a lot of our monarch activity, because we have a lot of generations, that's going on later in the summer, June, July, August, even into September. And the stuff that they use usually breaks down fairly quickly. Within about 2 weeks, it's basically broken down and degraded, and those products just aren't present anymore. So in the grand scheme of things, could there be some cases where monarchs in that local patch might be affected a little bit? It could happen, but overall, I don't think the spraying for gypsy moth is probably having a huge impact on the monarchs because of that location, also the timing again.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Brandon in Sparta, it is your turn. Hi, Brandon.
Hi. I've got an old wooden cylindrical drill bit holder that I picked up at a sale years ago, and I just keep it in a metal toolbox. It's not a toolbox I go in very often, but every once in a while I'll open it up and I'll look, and this drill bit holder's got some holes in it about the size of a head of a pin. And when I'll open the toolbox up, I'll notice some little wood shavings that have come out of these holes as if something's in there still eating, living in these holes. But this has been going on for years, and I was just wondering, with those simple clues, if you had any idea what that might be.
Yeah, so we talked about these earlier, but I suspect these powder post beetles again. And there's a bunch of different species, so they can prefer different types of wood, hardwood versus softwood. But in general, what they tend to do is leave small pinholes or about the size of a tip of a pen. And they often leave this fine, kind of talc-like powder coming out of those holes. Sometimes it's a little grittier than that. In a case like this, where it's not a big log cabin, probably the easiest thing you could do, assuming this is a small drill bit holder, would be to stick it in a freezer for a couple of weeks, and that would kill any of the insects that are still in there.
Oh.
Would just, now it's left out in the garage through the winter, would that not be cold enough?
Probably not, because these same powder post beetles, they'll live in standing dead trees and logs out in the woods, so they are used to going through the cold winter temperatures. To kill them off using freezing, we often need to put a shock on their system. So I would maybe even take that drill bit holder, bring it indoors and warm it up, warm up any insects that are in there, and then go from, you know, 65, 70 yeah. room temperature, put it in a nice cold freezer. That'll be a real shock on their system, and that will kill them off. If you just leave it in a cold garage all winter, they'll get used to that.
Adapt.
They'll kind of harden off and adapt.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Brandon. And Kathy in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Thank you so much for another wonderful program.
Thank you.
One of the five best experiences I've had in nature, I was sitting on my deck, and I could see the strand of silk and a bright pink ball in the middle of it. And I gently touched that strand, and a pink, tiny spiders went along the line of silk. And then I left it alone, and they came back together in that ball.
Oh.
It was marvelous.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, definitely neat observation. Do you happen to remember what time of year it was, Kathy?
I believe it was summer, as I recall. Of course, it's an old memory, but it was nice enough to sit out for a length of time.
Yeah.
I don't think it was very hot weather.
Okay.
I
would maybe wonder, given the description that with the pink color, a lot of our orb weavers, we get the adults in summer and fall, but they die out. The egg sacs sit there through the winter months, and then the young spiderlings emerge sometime in the spring or even early summer. I wonder if you might have bumped into a bundle of tiny orb weaver spiders. That might be a possibility.
Oh, it was beyond belief.
Oh.
I was just so... Well, it just teaches us that nature is the place to start.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Kathy, thank you so much for calling. And you mentioned orb weavers, and Leela posted up on our Facebook page a really nice shot of her pet orb weaver to go along with today's walking stick comments.
Yeah, so I probably talked about these last time I was on the show in September, but orb weavers can be very, very common. Late summer and early fall, they can often be big, flashy, kind of plump spiders, browns and yellows and pinks and reds and oranges. In many cases, they have very conspicuous patterns on the body, cross signs and four-leaf clover symbols and things like that. They're really pretty docile creatures. They often like to hang out on the side of homes. I've had one. It's gone now, but it was hanging out near our front door this late summer and fall.
Yeah.
And they just sit there and eat insects that they catch in their webs. Really pretty docile, gentle creatures.
Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Last summer, in 2016, I discovered ambush bugs on the south shore of Lake Superior, and it was the first time I had seen that insect. And this year, I was lucky enough to find a patch of goldenrod near our house, close to our house. And so I would go up, and watch them and photograph them. I wanted to see if I could find their eggs, because I think they might overwinter as eggs. And I looked at the stem. Oops, sorry, our dog.
It's all right.
I looked at the stem and couldn't find any on the stem. And I kind of looked under some of the leaves where they had been, but really couldn't find any eggs. And I'm just wondering, do you have any suggestions? Because I'd like to photograph them this winter if I could.
Yeah, so good question. To be honest, I don't know for sure where they lay their eggs. My suspicion, and I have seen images, and ambush bugs are technically a type of assassin bug. I've seen pictures of other assassin bugs where the eggs are laid in a small clump or cluster on plants, on stems or leaves, that sort of thing. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were laid in such locations. One caveat, though, is unless you saw the ambush bugs laying the eggs directly and you observed them, it'd probably be pretty hard to pin the eggs down as actually being from those versus something else. Often, insect egg identification is pretty tricky to do.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try again in the winter when I'm up there, but thanks. Thank you so much, and thanks for the program.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Pat. Art in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Last summer, the Japanese beetles were decimated some of the fruit trees in my yard, and I wondered if there's anything that preys on them that you could put out there to, other than, you know, trying to get rid of the grubs. So,
yeah,
that's my...
Yeah.
Yeah, so unfortunately, there's not really a magical predator that can eat enough of them to make much of a difference. That's kind of the short story. There are things that will eat them. A praying mantid, in theory, I suppose, could certainly munch on them, especially if you had a mantis sitting on a rose bush or something like that, and the beetles were sitting there on the flowers. I mean, they certainly could grab them and potentially eat them. Other things may eat Japanese beetles, certain birds and that type of thing. But overall, these Japanese beetles, because the females can lay so many eggs, for every beetle that gets eaten by some creature, you could have an awful lot more that make it to the adult stage. I would say in the long run, where it probably will affect the Japanese beetles more is some of our weather patterns. Sometimes that might cause a population to crash if it's too wet and they come down sick with a disease, for example. So that'll probably have more of an impact than the predators from my observations.
There we go. Thank you, Art, for calling. Appreciate your call. Rin on Facebook wonders if you have any tips on attracting dragonflies. Also, is it true that adults can prey on seemingly massive amounts of mosquitoes daily?
So in terms of attracting dragonflies, it can be more easily said than done. One reason for that is we've got well over 100 different species of dragonflies in the state, and each species is going to have different preferences in terms of its habitat. Certain ones will be really picky, and if you don't have the right habitat, you're just not going to be able to get them in your area. In general, though, dragonflies and the relatives of damselflies like water of some kind. So if you have a pond or a stream or a river near you, that's certainly going to make it more likely to have dragonflies by. Even if you put in, say, a small ornamental pond, I wouldn't expect it to draw in huge numbers of dragonflies, unfortunately. So it has to do more with your location in this case, with respect to the landscape around you in terms of getting dragonflies in. In terms of eating mosquitoes, dragonflies certainly can eat mosquitoes. I haven't seen specific research in terms of how many given dragonfly will eat in a day, and that may even vary by species in terms of their feeding preferences. But they certainly can eat mosquitoes, and I would give them more credit for eating mosquitoes than other creatures like bats that we know tend to feed more on larger moths and beetles, that sort of thing.
We have, just back to Facebook for a minute, Jane posted a nice photo of a mantis, and she said, my husband's an entomologist, works for apple orchards and small fruit growers on IPM approaches. And she's got some photos here. Were sent from Brighton Woods Orchard in Burlington, Wisconsin. And so she, it's a really cool photo of this matted on a deck looking out at an apple tree. We can talk some more about that. We are visiting today with Patrick P.J. Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Taking a look at the world of insects today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You may have noticed some unusual bugs around your home or yard this fall, or even right now. You may have a photo you want to send in to our Facebook page. We'd love to have that. You may have some other questions for PJ. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And speaking of Facebook, PJ, we were talking to Ron earlier, and he sent us a really cool photo. Why don't you describe that for us?
Yeah, so Ron had been discussing about feeding his mantids and actually putting food for him on a pin. And in the picture, believe it or not, there's the praying mantis. It's got the pin and one of its arms holding on to it. It's nibbling on something on the end of it. And as Ron said, he could hear the pin drop and he'd know it was done eating. I guess from my own experience, I had a colleague this past summer and he had some of these exotic mantids, which were just truly beautiful creatures from India and places like that. Some of those you could hold very readily and you could actually hand feed them, give them a cricket, and they would just grab it and munch away on it.
Well, that is a very, very cool photo, Ron. Thank you so much for sending it to us. And we have another orb weaver there, a nice photo there. And I wanted to bring up Matt in Wausau, emailed to say that he had a water scorpion climb out of his ice fishing hole while fishing on Lake Wausau a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so it turns out, Larry, that a lot of these aquatic insects have some natural adaptations, and they can stay somewhat active underneath the ice. And I've talked to colleagues that have said some of their best collecting of these insects has actually been in early spring, right when the ice comes off. They seem to be able to catch them more easily. So it's certainly the type of thing that would probably catch you off guard if you're ice fishing and one of these things came up out of the hole. But it does happen on occasion.
And Chad in South Range emailed us a photo, clusters of what he wonders are these eggs, insect eggs. They were on sidings and screens at his home in South Range. Could they be eggs?
Yeah, so given the size on the palm's hand in the picture, I'm suspicious they probably are insect eggs of some kind. I can think of some of the moths from our cutworm moth family that will lay eggs in large numbers on the siding of homes, and they really kind of plaster them on. You've got to scrape pretty good to get them off. There could be a number of other possibilities, though, and I mentioned this on the program earlier. Unless you see an insect laying the eggs, it's often kind of tricky to narrow down exactly the source of them.
And Robert on Facebook wonders if wasps die off like bees and leave the queen.
So with the species of wasps that we have that folks commonly think of, yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets and paper wasps, so they don't necessarily leave the queen. Basically, they start the colony from scratch, and the queen that made it through the previous winter has to start the colony. Eventually, she has workers that take over the duties. At the end of the season, she's going to die out with the colony. So that queen basically lives a year. But certain females from that colony will leave. They will mate. They'll spend the winter, and they will be the new queens next year.
Gotcha. Let's go to Todd in Milwaukee next. Hi, Todd. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had a very weird experience last year. A large spider likes to go by my back sliding door, and as a daily ritual, make a large spider web, and in order for me to get out the door, I would just kind of get rid of the spider web, but never would touch the spider. And over the summer, this thing got really, really, really large, well-fed spider. And it's normally, though, was never seen during the day. But one day it was just kind of out in the middle of its web, and I was trying to figure out a way to get rid of the web without disturbing the spider too much. And a very large black wasp came and literally snatched this large spider out of the web and was gone in like 2 seconds. It was so fast. I was trying to find out, you know, what kind of a wasp goes after spiders? I've never seen it before, and I wasn't aware of any wasps that were carnivorous or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, interesting.
So two possibilities I can think of in this case, and first of all, it's a really interesting observation that you got to see that some of our yellow jackets, the true yellow jackets and things like bald-faced hornets, they can be generalist predators, and they often go for things like caterpillars. Could they potentially go after a spider? I'd say it might happen on occasion. Another possibility, we have a group we actually call the spider wasps, and they specifically hunt down spiders. They usually sting and paralyze them, take them back to their nest, and that's basically what they feed to their young. So there's this group of wasps that specifically seek out spiders as a food source for their young.
Interesting. I did not know that. Todd?
And it was definitely a black spider, though. I mean, this was not a yellow jacket. I know what they looked like. This was for sure a large black wasp, and but it was so fast, and I was standing maybe a foot and a half from the spider, and this thing just came in. So I just thought I'd share that with you because I had never known a wasp that was, you know, something that would go after a spider, especially if spiders are, you know, they can fight back.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I guess with the description, I would maybe lean more towards one of those spider wasps then. If you go to other places on the planet, some of these wasps can be very, very large. There are even some that specifically hunt down tarantulas.
Wow.
So those can be some impressive wasps.
Oh, man. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you so much for your comments.
Appreciate it. Brad in New London, it's your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Hi, good afternoon. I want to have Patrick talk about ground nesting hornets, how they excavate their nests, and usually in late summer or early fall, the nests have been dug out. I just wonder if you know what kind of animal would do that.
Sure. So in terms of digging, and we talked about this a minute ago, but these nests get started from scratch in the spring or early summer with one lone female, and she's not able to just start digging into a lawn and making a large cavity to put a nest. What usually happens is that these nests are built in locations where there's some type of pre-existing cavity of some kind. So if you had an old chipmunk burrow or rodent burrow in your yard, if you fill it in this time of the year before next spring, you can prevent nesting. But otherwise, those new queens next year are looking specifically for locations like that. They can also go to hollow kind of cavities or voids in compost piles, wood piles, maybe other locations like that where there's some type of pre-existing cavity just because they're not great at digging overall.
Yeah, or a half a bag of my garden soil.
Yeah.
Where I got stung a few times this summer.
Yeah, they can be pretty creative sometimes. In terms of digging around the nest later in the summer, the wasps might be able to do a little bit of excavation, but certain mammals might get in there. It'd be kind of a risky chance a mammal would have to take to get in. But if you did get into a wasp nest and were able to eat a lot of those larvae that are in there, that'd be a pretty good protein source for you. So you could have had a mammal that might have been foraging in there as well.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. I tell you, I opened up that bag finally after that last really cold spell we had, and I didn't even see anything in there, so it must be there down in the dirt, I would imagine. I didn't dig around.
That could be, yeah. And often what happens is, even though they're down in the soil, they still build that paper mache type nest. And I've been out with when I was a graduate student digging up some of these yellow jacket nests with other grad students, and you dig through the soil and all of a sudden it looks like one of the paper mache type nests you'd expect to see up in a tree, and it's down there in the soil.
I am going to have to excavate that bag. I guess maybe I'll do that today when I get home from work. That'll be interesting to see for sure. If I find it, I'll take a good photo and we'll post it up on our Facebook page for sure. You can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. Larry in Downing called to ask if there are a lot of blister beetles in Wisconsin.
Yes, so I don't have an exact number off the top of my head. I would say perhaps on the range of a couple dozen in the state. It's not a huge family of beetles. We do have some very common ones. There are some that are black with grayish stripes, some that have a lot of different color stripes on the body. Some of our biggest blister beetles are about an inch long in a metallic turquoise color, so they've got a really pretty appearance to them. So there are a number of species around. They tend to either be parasites of grasshoppers, or in some cases, they actually are associated with various ground nesting bees. So they've got some interesting life cycles.
Kristen on Facebook wonders about zombie ant fungus. What is the zombie ant fungus?
So this is a really cool story that's been in the news lately. Basically, what goes on is there are certain fungi, we call them entomopathogenic fungi, or basically insect-killing fungi, and their strategy is to infect an insect, and in some cases, they alter the behavior of the insect, and in the case of the ants, they alter the behavior of the ant, they cause it to climb up to an elevated location, so a twig or a leaf above the ground. And then the ant dies, the fungus produces all these spores and fruiting bodies, and that way, because they're up off the ground, the wind can disperse those spores and go and infect other insects. So there's been some really interesting stories in the news about the zombie ant fungus lately, but there's a lot more than that. I commonly see one that goes after flies. So if you're ever out in your garden and it's a rainy June, you sometimes see flies that are latched onto the edge of a leaf. Yeah. Those have been killed by a fungus. They're up high so that those spores can disperse. So it's
very
really interesting.
Yeah. Tony in Clintonville, it's your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I have a question. How would I get rid of termites in my wood pile?
Clintonville. Or, no. Okay. Are you sure they're termites?
No, I'm not. But it's super fine dust. And I wouldn't believe it would be there from when I cut it. I mean, it's just like sugar pine.
Okay, that sounds like powder post beetles again.
Yeah, I would really be suspicious that it's something other than termites. We do technically have a species of termite in Wisconsin, the eastern subterranean termite. Overall, it's extremely rare. We just don't bump into it out in the woods. It's basically a more southern species. Where we do have it in Wisconsin, it's basically someone brought infested wood materials up here. They built a home or another building, and those termites are basically restricted to individual buildings or a block here, a block there. So they're quite rare. In this case, I would wonder, as Larry mentioned, powder post beetles. There could be a number of other things in wood, especially if it was standing dead pines. You could have all kinds of creatures, powder post beetles and many other beetles in there as well.
Is there something I should
be worried about, throwing it in the house or not?
Is this wood that's going to be used for firewood?
Yes.
Okay. In general, I really wouldn't be too concerned about it. What I would do, my main piece of advice would be to leave the firewood out in a cool or cold location versus bringing it indoors. If you take a bunch of firewood, bring it indoors. The insects that are in there are going to think it's springtime already. They're going to complete their development, and you'll get them wandering around the house when the adults pop out. They're not going to hurt anything, but they'll be a bit of a nuisance. So I would simply take that firewood, leave it out in a cold spot. When you're ready to burn it, bring in enough for a couple of days at a time and use it up fairly quickly.
Well, very good. Thank you much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And on to Paul in Oshkosh. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I was doing some work on the north side of Madison last summer, and I saw, I don't know if it was a bee or a wasp, but they were just gigantic. I'd never seen one that size. I mean, they were close to 2 inches long, and they were all over. I was parked on the street. They were all over the street and all around my truck. They didn't seem aggressive, but I tried to look them up, and I couldn't figure out what it was. I was wondering if you had any idea.
Sure.
Yeah, so my first idea is that they might have been one of the solitary ground nesting wasps. Probably my first guess would be something I would call a cicada killer wasp. And these are solitary ground nesters. The females go out, catch a cicada. They bring it back. That's what they feed to their young. They can be about 2 or so inches long sometimes. They would look kind of like an overgrown yellow jacket.
About what this looked like, okay. Yeah.
Then it's probably those cicada killers. They can be really, really common. Starting in about late June, July is a great time to find them if you're looking for them. Even into August, maybe into September, too, you can find them. But they can really be pretty common in the state.
Okay. I just was surprised. I work outside all the time. I'd never seen something that size before. But like I said, they didn't seem aggressive. But it was about late July that I was down there. So that probably would be it then.
Yep. Yeah. Sounds like it.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the call. And let's go to Carissa next in Wausau. Hi, Carissa.
Hi. I have a question about wasps. At our house here in Wausau, the warmer side of the house always seems to have at least two different species of wasps at any given time from May to October. And they're definitely a pest for us. There's sometimes, you know, hundreds of them swarming at a time. We have little kids and a dog, and I'm wondering if there's anything I can do to discourage them from starting to nest around our house. So we've used an exterminator, you know, to help control the population. But is there anything I can do to discourage them from wanting to hang out around our house?
Sure. And I guess a quick question to follow up with the description. Are these wasps building nests that hang down from the soffit areas, or are they getting into nooks and crannies in say, the soffit overhang or behind siding?
Once the leaves fell off the trees, I found one hanging nest, but I am pretty certain that we also have some crawling into nooks and crannies.
Okay. We do have a number of yellow jacket species that like to get indoors in nooks and crannies. One of the best things to help with those in the long run would be to look at those entrance points and try to physically seal it up with caulk, expanding insulation foam, something else along those lines to create a physical barrier. That way they can't get in the first place. Another thing that can be helpful is look for when the nests begin in the year, because those nests get started from scratch in spring or early summer. And so if you notice the early activity, maybe wasps going in or out in June, if we have the nest treated then, the nest is relatively small. There might be a few dozen workers present, versus if we don't keep an eye out for it and we wait until we see a lot of activity in August or September, well, by then that nest has hundreds or thousands of individuals, and then your risks of getting stung go up quite a bit. So physically sealing things up, that exclusion method, but also kind of monitoring and catching things early can help quite a bit and prevent issues later on in the summer.
All right.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Carissa. And Chris in Watertown. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Larry and PJ. I'm protective of my goofy squirrels in the backyard. No, there are no nut trees anywhere in the area. The squirrels are digging up. I heard you talk about the underground nests. They are digging up these little groups of things, and I heard you talk about the underground nests. Do squirrels dig up insects?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not that I'm aware of either.
Now, when you think of common nut trees, things like acorns from oaks and walnuts and things like that, you might not have some of those around, although they will sometimes go after other trees. I have seen them go after seed cones on conifers and other tree seeds as well. So just because you don't have oaks or walnuts around, there could be some other seed sources that we're overlooking that they might be trying to dig a hole for.
Not even a pine tree.
Yeah. It's maybe they're bringing them over from the neighbors, Chris.
I'm just confused. I'm going, oh, are they digging up hornet's nests or what?
No.
No, I wouldn't expect them to. I would maybe, you could go out and even chase the squirrel away and poke around and see what they're finding, but I would be suspicious it's some type of plant seed of some kind. I wouldn't expect them to be trying to dig up wasp or any other insects.
Yeah.
Okay. I just don't want them to get hurt.
Okay, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, back to Facebook for a minute. Linda sent us a nice photo of a butterfly, black and white, black with white kind of spots almost.
Yes, it's really a striking looking creature.
Really is.
Given the appearance, so there's two creatures that look an awful lot like this, and they're distant relatives. I suspect this is from the inchworm group. So this is actually a moth.
A moth.
Yeah, there's one called the eight-spotted forester, which has basically four white spots on one side of the body, four on the other side. There's another lookalike, so you got to look closely at the amount of orange on the legs and other parts of the body to really tell them apart. But I suspect this is from that inchworm group, and it may be the eight-spotted forester moth.
That's really pretty, really pretty. And Cheryl sent us another walking stick photo that's pretty cool. It was on the outside wall of their cottage near Holcomb, Wisconsin.
Neat.
Yeah, very nice photo. And then Diana also sent us a photo of a walking stick going up the side of a wooden wall.
Yeah, again, very neat. I'm a little bit jealous. I will admit this year, I don't think I saw any walking sticks myself. Often the easiest place for me to spot them is if I'm up at Devil's Lake State Park or nearby areas in late summer, August or September. If you just sit down in the woods and kind of wait and watch, you often see them just slowly wandering around in the woods.
You know, if anybody comes and asks you what you're doing, you say, I'm hunting the walking stick. I don't know, PJ. They might look at you a little strangely. Well, I tell you what, the music tells me that we are about out of time. You are going to be back in January on January 17th. And so we'll certainly look forward to that visit. And thank you again for being with us today. It was really a lot of fun.
Sure. My pleasure, Larry.
Patrick P.J. Leash, degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the UW. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he'll be back on January 17th, and we'll do this all over again. I think Phil Pelletieri will be visiting us in December. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at the benefits of yoga and how you can find the right instructor, so I hope you can join us for that. And you know what? There's a lot going on all afternoon, so please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.